From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been one Earth year since the two-ton, car-sized Curiosity rover touched down on the surface of Mars. That's one year with 70,000 images gathered, 75,000 lasered rock analyses, 190 gigabytes of data, two rock samples, and with that, a lot of wild discoveries. Today, we'll talk with two big shots from NASA and more about what they've learned and what challenges lay ahead. This hour on Point, Curiosity's first year on the Red Planet. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Were you there for the 7 minutes of terror and the Mohawk guy in charge of it? Were you blown away with the news of potential life on Mars? Are you still? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is J. Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. He writes about planetary science and space exploration and keeps a watchful eye from the goings-on up above. Kelly Beatty, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, John. Great, thanks.
And also joining us from Southern California Public Radio in Pasadena are two top scientists on the Curiosity rover project, John Grotzinger and Jennifer Trosper. John Grotzinger is chief project scientist for the NASA Mars Science Laboratory project, the Curiosity project, developed by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory out of the California Institute of Technology. He's also a professor of geology at the California Institute of Technology under the Division of Geological and Planetary Sciences. John Grotzinger, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Trosper is deputy project manager for the Curiosity project. She's part of the engineering team that's communicating and actually controlling the Curiosity Mars rover. She was also the project systems engineer for the Spirit and Opportunity rovers and worked on other rovers as well. Jennifer Trosper, welcome to you too.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
Kelly, I want you to start off and get us oriented. And I'm talking about really oriented for the people who know nothing about this. Mars is a very long way away. No human being's ever been there. When was it that the United States or any country first showed the ability to land a vehicle or a device of any kind on Mars? And where does Curiosity fit in the history of those efforts?
Sure. And if you discount a Soviet lander that kind of failed right after it landed in 1973, the first landing was in 1976, a pair of U.S. spacecraft called Vikings, which have in some ways some commonality with Curiosity. They were complicated. They were expensive. They rocketed to the surface of the planet. The goal is to try to find out just how Earth-like Mars really is. Of all the planets in the solar system, Mars is the one most like ours. It's got it's very, very cold, much colder than on Earth, but it's a pretty benign environment. It's got a thin atmosphere. It has seasons. It has polar caps. It has geology that people like Dr. Grotzinger can relate to. And so it's a great place to find out more about our solar system. And in particular, Earth is a very complicated planet. Mars is simpler. So if you can understand Mars, it gives you a leg up on understanding the Earth.
And so how many devices are now sitting on Mars and gathering information for us?
This is great. This is a bet I have with my students all the time. So there are two rovers. There is Curiosity and also Opportunity, which has been on the surface for almost 10 years, coming up in January. And there are three orbiters. There is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is a NASA mission, Mars Odyssey, also a NASA mission, and then Mars Express, which is a European mission. So we've kind of got the planet covered.
And do we think that Curiosity, which landed in a crater and is about to embark on a journey to a mountain a few miles away, is it somehow because of how recently it got there, the most technologically advanced and most important to the advance of knowledge?
Oh, far and away. This is the most complicated spacecraft ever set down anywhere, Mars included. And it needs to be that complicated because it has a challenging objective. It has to determine whether Mars was ever truly Earth-like, whether it was a place that life could have evolved. And we need to be clear, it is not testing for life. The Vikings did, but the results were kind of controversial. Curiosity is a roving geological laboratory, and it's powered by radioactive plutonium. It has a long road ahead of it. It's in there for at least a couple of years, maybe longer. And the goal is in the middle of this crater called Gale Crater, which is about 100 miles across, is a stack of sediments like pancakes 3 miles high. And the way these sediments were laid down, the bottom ones were first to go down very early in the history of Mars, maybe 4 billion years ago. And then the top ones were much, much more recent. So in this 3 mile stack is probably a couple of billion years of Martian history. And just like going through the Grand Canyon, you can tell things about in the layers of the Grand Canyon about what the environment was at that time. So too will Curiosity tell us about the past environment of Mars. And in particular, why did Mars start out as a more wet and probably more clement place with, you know, rivers and clouds and rain maybe? And today it's hyper-arid, very cold, and a place that is not very suitable for life.
John Grotzinger, I want to ask you about what you think has been learned and accomplished by the Curiosity mission. But I want to start by playing a clip of when it landed just a year ago and the thrill of that particular moment. Let's take a listen.
Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars.
John Grotzinger, 1 year later, is that still the signal accomplishment of this mission, or have there been bigger ones?
Well, there have been a number of accomplishments. Unquestionably, the successful landing of Curiosity on the surface of Mars with that complicated EDL system is a tremendous triumph of engineering. And after that moment, one of the things that the scientists were worrying, myself in particular, was would we be able to match that with meeting the mission goals, which were ambitious, and that was the discovery of a habitable environment. And we wondered if that would ever happen, but the greatest surprise was when we actually accomplished that just 8 months after landing.
And what is the significance, what is the utility to those of us on Earth of knowing that Mars was once, billions of years ago, habitable?
It's important for several reasons. One is that if you can demonstrate that a place like Mars, which is so Earth-like, it's not a sister, but it's a cousin, it's close enough to Earth that we always wonder if you replayed the tape here on Earth and you allowed prebiotic chemistry to take its course under different circumstances, would it result in the origin of life? And Mars is kind of our chance to do that experiment. So as scientists, you know, we could look around our solar system and imagine all kinds of wild places where life may have gotten started. But on Mars, we see the closest comparison to what we have on Earth. So when you look at Mars and when you look at these rocks, which many people think of rocks as resources or something to look at when you check into the hotel room, we think of them as time capsules, and they preserve a record of the early evolution of Mars. And those early moments of Mars are actually better preserved than the same time period is on Earth. So by studying rocks on Mars that are literally billions and billions of years old, we get a better insight into our own origins here.
Jennifer Trosper, on behalf of everyone who's ever lost a cell phone signal in an elevator or in a basement somewhere, tell me how you are able to oversee communication between those of us on Earth and this device on Mars, and how long does that communication take?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But right now, the one-way light time from Earth to Mars is about 20 minutes. And it varies depending on Earth-Mars distance. Earth-Mars distance is pretty far right now because we just came out of solar conjunction. But what we do is we command the rover in the mornings when we have a direct Earth link. And when I say morning, I mean Mars morning. It takes about 20 minutes for the signal to get there. And we usually send about 15 minutes of instructions at about 2,000 bits per second. And then the rover goes off and does its thing all day, and we actually don't communicate with it during that time. We send it the full set of instructions, during the Mars day, it drives or it samples or it drills. It does whatever we've programmed it to do through that uplink in the morning. And then in the afternoon, in order to be more efficient with our energy, we actually send the data that tells us how it went back to Earth via the orbiters that you talked about earlier, Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, both overfly in the afternoon, probably 3 or 4 p.m. It varies a little bit. And we can send quite a bit of data for a lot less energy to those orbiters. And then since they're big orbiters with big solar panels and big batteries, they send that data back to Earth for us. We look at that data, see how it went, and then we start that all over again the next day.
Jennifer, I'm going to resume our conversation in the next block and ask you exactly how those signals are sent. But we're going to take a break for a moment. We're talking about the year inside Gale Crater, the life of the Curiosity rover on Mars. Every morning at Gale Crater on Mars, NASA researchers wake up the Curiosity rover with a special song like the Beatles' Good Morning, Good Morning, Wagner's Ride of the Valkyrie, or here, Good Morning from the 1952 film Singing in the Rain. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
When we left the movie show, the future wasn't bright. But came the dawn, the show goes on, and I don't want to say goodnight.
Don't say good morning!
Good morning!
Rainbows are shining through.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Bonjour.
Monsieur.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno.
Good morgen.
Guten Morgen.
Good morning to you.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Big Red Planet, what the Curiosity rover has learned in the past year and could learn in the future. Joining me today is Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, Also on the panel from the Curiosity Mars rover project out of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the California Institute of Technology, we have John Grotzinger, chief project scientist, and Jennifer Trosper, deputy project manager. Jennifer, two-part question. One part is from Dave Diamond, who sends us a note on Twitter. How do you operate the Curiosity rover without real-time communication? I assume the movements are small to avoid accidents. So deal with that question, and then maybe before that, my rather simpler one, which is what is the mechanism by which you transmit messages that take 20 minutes, that arrive in Mars 20 minutes later?
Yeah, the mechanism, there's actually something called the Deep Space Network that has these very large dishes, 70-meter diameter. We have three complexes in order to have them separated around the Earth. So whatever orientation the Earth is, we always have a complex that's pointed at Mars. So we have Goldstone, California, Madrid, Spain, and Canberra, Australia. There are these big 70-meter dishes. They can transmit up to 400 kilowatts for deep space communications. And we use radio waves to transmit these bits on a signal, and we send them to our antennas, which are much smaller on the surface of Mars. So that's the first question. The second question is interesting because if you think about how we're used to doing remote control vehicles here on Earth, you know, like my five-year-old son, he's got a little remote control truck, and he makes it go forward, he makes it go backward, and when he sees the wall, he stops sometimes or not. But
now, I assume this is not a store-bought remote control truck. This is something that you have designed for him at a very high level of sophistication.
Yeah, that would be great. However, I spend most of my time working on the Mars rover, so yeah, he gets the store-bought remote control trucks, unfortunately, but you know, he has several, so... the other one that's kind of cool is I think it's Finn McMissile that actually climbs the wall, but we don't do that. But anyway, so remote control operations on Mars is quite a bit different. The way that we do, well, you can imagine if you do it like on Earth, you're getting the images from Mars and you start telling the rover to do something. It doesn't make any sense because the images you're seeing are from 20 minutes before, and whatever the rover has done, it was going to do. And even if you just get those images and tell it to do something, you can't interact with it and the environment in real time. So now Lunokhod actually did that on the moon because the light time isn't significant. It's a little bit, but it's not significant like it is on Mars. So what we do is every day we download the images to the ground, And we have this group of people called rover planners look at all the terrain, and we plan the rover traverse. We can either use blind driving, where we actually designate the full traverse with waypoints and keep-in zones, and we tell the rover exactly where to go. And the way we keep it on track is with something called visual odometry, where we have the cameras take pictures every half a meter or so, and in those pictures it finds points in those pictures, rocks, things that it can look at every half meter and make sure that it actually has driven a half meter. And then we use the IMU on the rover to make sure that the orientations and the tilts are as expected. And so we do very safe blind driving. The other thing we do is something called auto navigation, which we haven't enabled yet. But in that, the rover software itself decides, we'll give it a point that we want it to get to, and it will decide what obstacles it can, where the obstacles are, just by taking images and building what we call these traverse maps, which have green, yellow, and red areas. This is all done autonomously on board.
I think Detroit's working on that same technology right now, driverless, hands-free driving.
Yeah. So anyway, the rover is smart enough to keep itself away from obstacles, because we obviously can't do that with the light time limitations of Mars being so far away.
Let's go to a listener. We've got Paul on the line from Buffalo, New York. Paul, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I hate to be a wet blanket, but I have to question the value of exploring Mars, either by robots or by human, at this point in human history. The tremendous amount of resources, Earth resources, valuable fuel, and so forth, that go into a trip to Mars, the tremendous amount of money, the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, or the trillions that it would take to send humans to Mars, are way out of proportion to anything we could learn up there in terms of the similarities between Mars and Earth. We have on this planet a global warming problem that demands our urgent attention. Any space travel should be dedicated to this planet, our home planet. We have a billion people or more on this planet starving or very malnourished because of the weather and the agriculture. This planet is in danger.
Paul, that's a great point. I want to put that question to Kelly Beatty, because I'm sure it's one that commonly is posed to people who are involved in this kind of work. How do you respond to it?
Right. Well, Paul, let me just try to touch on a couple of things. First of all, this is a $2.5 billion mission over its lifetime, and that sounds like a lot of money. Most of that money is not spent on sending bricks of gold to Mars. It's sent on the salaries of the – there are 400 people on the science team. There are many hundreds, if not thousands, of other people associated with it who draw salaries. They contribute to the economy, and so that is money that stays here on Earth. The other, my old college professor once told me, things like exploring are something that a civilization does because it can. And I take your point about the other problems that we have here on Earth. In some cases, we have solutions for those that there is just not the political will to commit the resources to solving them. I think global warming is a perfect case in point. We know what to do, but there's a lot of pushback from a lot of different quarters on fighting that because it's bad for the economy. In this case, we have a situation where we are learning about Mars in a way that will help us learn about Earth, about the future of Earth and its past, and I think it will pay dividends in that way.
John Grotzinger, you're out in Pasadena, California, but how do you see the dynamics in a political sense about the funding for the kind of work that you're engaged in? When you think about contemporary politicians, who's a real champion of space exploration? Newt Gingrich comes to mind. He didn't get elected. What's happened to the budget of this kind of work under the Obama administration? What do you see in the future?
Yeah, let me just take a step back and briefly just add to what Kelly was saying, because this is a really important point that is relevant to the second. The point that Kelly was making is we don't take that $2.5 billion, put it inside Curiosity, and send it to Mars. All that money is spent on literally thousands of contractors, subcontractors distributed across this country in pretty much every state have contributed something to the mission. And it's not just the science team. The second point is that the cost of this for if you take all the citizens of the U.S. and divide it by the total price tag, it's less than the cost of a movie. And I think most people would agree, just looking at those pictures, that that's a pretty good movie. And the third thing is the most important, which is that missions like this, it is well known, capture the attention of kids in middle school and high school that are going to choose a career path to do one thing, or they're going to do science and engineering. And that's something that this country desperately needs. All those issues, global warming, agriculture, how to combat drought, a lot of the technologies that are used in studying those kinds of problems are fed by kids that make that decision, and we need that badly. To get to the issue about what's going on in Congress, it's not a good situation, and it's not something that's limited to any particular administration. If you go back, a historian will look back at the at NASA's 50 years since Apollo and see one of a progressive decline in the budget, and it doesn't make sense in the context of the need to explore space, and especially the economic engine that is driven by the technologies that are developed as we're trying to get into space. So I really hope that things will turn around here, and that curiosity will inspire some folks to bolster the budget.
Let's take another call. We've got Joan on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Joan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I'm a proud NASA mother. How do you like that? My son, Mike Meacham's at JPL. He's one of the engineers who worked on the team that built the mast for Curiosity. The mast holds the cameras and the scientific equipment. What we spend on that rover is less than a few weeks at war, and it's 10 years of technology. It's an unbelievably great investment for America. Right now, my son's out in the Mojave Desert. He's testing this rocket sled, the deceleration project. He's testing parachute landings for the next rover. They have these enormous-sized parachutes. They can't even test them in wind tunnels anymore. So they work in collaboration with the Navy and other contractors to really learn how to do this. They're learning so much about what it takes to make a great accomplishment, a great human accomplishment. The new video that's out, the four-minute video this week on 1 year of the rover, starts by saying that everything great requires a great team, requires many people working together. And that's what we have to learn in industry today. And just I'll end with a very funny two quotes. In the four-minute video, when they ask the NASA representative at the launch, he says, am I confident she's going to go and be successful? Absolutely. And then if you listen very carefully in the descent after 8 months later when they're coming to Mars, the people at Mission Control, when they get so moved, I cry every time when I see that, they actually say, I can't believe we really did it. And that's the spirit of accomplishment.
Joan, thanks so much for your call. Jennifer, it sounds as if Joan's helping you out on multiple levels, not just with the inspirational message, but with the contribution of her son.
Yeah, Joan, in fact, I think that's a good example of how we're trying to move towards bigger technologies to land larger things. I think about when I was at NASA headquarters several years ago, one of the things that we actually created was a roadmap, and we got the human exploration people together with the robotic exploration people who had been landing small masses on Mars. And the project that she's talking about is one of the things that came out of that, where we decided we needed to put some money in developing larger parachutes and ways to land larger masses in order to eventually get to where we can land a human mission on Mars. So thanks, Joan, for your son's contribution, and it's all moving towards some really neat things in the future.
You know, Joan was talking about parachute landings. NASA has a video that was about the moment when you had the Curiosity coming down with the during the rocket phase of the landing. And let's take a listen to that.
Once we turn those rocket motors on, if we don't do something, we're just going to smack right back into the parachute. So the first thing we do is make this really radical divert. We fly off to the side.
diverting away from the parachute, killing our horizontal velocity and our vertical velocity, getting the rover moving straight up and down so it can look at the surface with its radar and see where we're going to land. And we head straight down to the bottom of a crater.
Jennifer, what's next in terms of our capacity to land equipment and maybe someday people on Mars?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, the parachute, getting a parachute that can land a larger mass, and these are hypersonic parachutes, so, you know, they're parachutes that have to actually survive at very high speeds. And we're doing some testing in the next few years where we're testing out that parachute and trying to get larger mass landings for Mars. For the next rover will be similar to Curiosity, but potentially would have larger mass due to the different payloads. So we're on the path to getting humans there someday, we hope.
Let's take another call. John from Burlington, Vermont. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. My question basically is, are we Martians? The geologic record on Earth suggests that it was basically sterile in the lab. Very primitive molecules can be produced. But all of a sudden, in our record, a very complex molecule, that is DNA, showed up. Where did it come from? Did it get a piece of Mars knocked off by interplanetary, some rocks have been found on, Antarctica, et cetera. So did we have Earth sort of inoculated with DNA from Mars?
John Grotzinger, have we got it backwards? If there was life on Mars billions of years ago, is that where it started? And we're second fiddle.
It's an excellent question. One of my colleagues at Caltech that teaches an introductory course does discuss that possibility. So it's quite a responsible thought. It's harder to demonstrate where our roots actually lie because of the difficulty of preservation of organic materials in the rock record here on Earth, which, by the way, is also one of our great challenges for Curiosity on Mars. We would like to look for organic molecules there, but you have to deal with how sediments in water get converted into hard rock. That's often destructive. So if you take something like DNA, which is a very, very complex organic molecule, and you map it back into the rock record, it disappears long before we see the actual hard parts of organisms, things like dinosaur bones, for example. They vastly exceed the record of DNA. So we can't take organic molecules per se and use those as an indicator of when something originated on Earth, because there's a big difference between the origination event and when the material actually gets preserved. So that's one of the important things that we learn to do with Curiosity is borrow from our experience here on Earth to do a better job of predicting what we might expect to find on Mars.
Kelly, quick take. Are we the Martians?
Yeah, John, that's a really great question. This is actually a field of study called panspermia. And there is a school of thought that—
Panspermia.
Panspermia, where life is transferred from one world to another. It is entirely possible that Mars had life in its early form and that it maybe hitchhiked to Earth. The problem is, as John was pointing out, it would be very, very difficult to prove.
We will come back to that subject after the break. We're talking with two top scientists and a big planetary watcher on the Curiosity rover project on Mars. Released in August 2012, Will.i.am's song Reach for the Stars became the first song ever to broadcast on another planet. Here it is.
When I see the footprints on the moon, and I know the sky might be high, but baby, it ain't really that high. And I know that Mars might be far, but baby, it ain't really that far. Let's reach for the stars.
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 This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing the Mars rovers and their future, scientific, budgetary. With us today in the studio, we have Kelly Beatty, senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Also with us from Southern California Public Radio, John Grotzinger, Chief Project Scientist, and Jennifer Trosper, Deputy Project Manager for the Curiosity Mars Rover Project out of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the California Institute for Technology. Now, on Monday, the Curiosity rover passed the one Earth year mark since it landed on Mars. Programmed by the rover's onboard chemistry lab, the rover sang an Earth-like 120-year-old folk song into the arid plains of Mars. It's Happy Birthday. Let's listen. So, Jennifer Trosper, when kids are around one, they're usually walking by then. So, Dave Diamond from Facebook has a question that I pretty practical that maybe you could answer. What happens if Curiosity gets stuck?
Yeah, well, we actually have some experience with that in the past on previous rovers. We had, you know, the Sojourner rover didn't get stuck, but we had some precarious positions it got into when it climbed up on a rock, and the Spirit rover had gotten stuck on a few occasions. So we actually, because of our experience, we're very careful about the terrains that we drive in. And one of the things that we've done is we've actually added to our rover planner staff a soil property scientist that works with the rover planners and understands from a scientific point of view what the properties of the soil are to make sure that we understand the type of soil we're driving into and that we wouldn't get stuck. And if we think it's that kind of soil, we drive around it. And if we do for some reason get stuck, which is obviously what we try to avoid, we have lots of different things we can try in our turns in place and the way that we move the wheels to attempt to get out of that. But in general, we try not to get stuck.
Let's take a call from Shane from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Shane, you're on Point.
Hey, John. I really like the whole Mars project, and I think it's a great idea. I'm just curious, when I took a couple courses in astronomy and physics in college and high school, we spoke a lot about maybe moving a base to the moon as a more viable way to launch ships into space, you know, towards Mars, instead of having to break the Earth's atmosphere and gravitational pull every time you want to send a rover or something out. Is there any interest in that in NASA still?
Kelly Beatty?
Well, yeah, there is, Shane. The key is, if you have to build these spacecraft on the moon and launch them, where are you going to get the fuel for it? And that situation just got a little bit more promising. Instead of having to ship up the fuel from the Earth and then launch them, you might be able to tap into some polar deposits that have recently been discovered on the moon where there is ice. Now, we don't know how much ice there is there, but that's a potential because you can take that ice, break it down into its hydrogen and oxygen, and you've got rocket fuel. I think that's a ways away. There is some thought about going back to the moon, but a permanent base is probably still decades away.
Let's take another call. We've got Doc on the line from Pembroke, Massachusetts. Doc, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, hey, John and crew. Two things. One is, if we're looking for life, shouldn't we be looking at the poles of Mars, where I believe there is ice, or also deep crevices that are concealed from the solar radiation? And the second thing is there a website or a television show that us people can go to keep updated on a regular basis on the progress of NASA projects?
Doc, thanks for your call. John Grotzinger?
Yeah, sorry. What was the question again?
The question was, if life is predicated on water, why isn't the why haven't we sent our exploratory machinery to the poles of Mars? Because that's more likely where water either is or has been in the form of ice. And secondly, is there a website where people can stay updated on the progress of this mission?
Yeah, the answer to the second one quickly. We do have a website at JPL. If you just go to Google and type in MSL and JPL, you can see a bunch of good stuff there, including a map that shows our progress as we're driving along. With regard to the first one, it's always been desirable to go to the poles for exactly that reason. There's water there. It is ice, but we know from studies in Antarctica that certain microorganisms can tolerate that kind of environment. And I think many members of the Mars community regard the polar ice caps as the best chance to explore modern Mars in terms of its habitability and even the possibility for life. The problem is that to meet NASA requirements for planetary protection, the spacecraft would have to be so clean because you are landing on water and the requirement is very stiff that you not contaminate the surface. Think of the Antarctic Treaty, where the UN is a governing body that ensures that the land is shared properly between all interested parties. It's the same thing for planetary protection, and we take that very seriously. So Curiosity, because it lands at the equator and it's on soil and it's on rock, its requirements are lower. And therefore, it costs less.
The equivalent of interplanetary EPA regulations.
It is pretty much like that. It's a separate group that is only loosely affiliated with NASA, and they sort of function as a watchdog organization. And they have the ability to pull the plug at any point in the process if they feel we're not being responsible.
And I just want to jump in here, Doc, and let you know that there have been two spacecraft that NASA has sent to the poles of Mars. The first was unfortunately called Mars Polar Lander. It crashed and was never heard from. It was very sad. This was about a decade ago. And then more recently, there was a spacecraft called Phoenix, which was successful. It landed. It had a claw. It was supposed to analyze some of that ice for stuff. And one of the things that we learned from that mission that I'm sure that John and Jennifer are applying to this one, the soil, because it had all this ice in it, got real clumpy and it was really hard to handle. And I think that was a take-home lesson that is being applied to Curiosity. We didn't get as much data from Phoenix as we would have liked to about the situation in the polar regions, but you're absolutely right. It's a very fertile, if you'll pardon the pun, a fertile place to look for life.
Kelly, I want to follow up with a question that I don't even know if this question makes sense, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why do we look for evidence of life on Mars by the reference points that we're familiar with on Earth? In other words, if the presence of water and ice billions of years ago was an indication of ice of habitability, why isn't it possible that there's some other form of life that we don't even understand that might exist on Mars?
Oh, you're absolutely right. The problem is that looking for life as we know it is the only kind that we know to look for. So it depends on what you define life to be. Is it, you know, a self-replicating sentient being? If you saw a rock on Mars suddenly, like, you know, divide in two and you knew it was just made of silicate minerals, you'd have to really scratch your head and say, hey, what's going on here? And again, I want to emphasize that searching for life is a real challenge. And this spacecraft is not doing that. That doesn't mean it can't detect organic materials, and that's one of the challenges down the road. Mars is a harsh environment. It has a lot of ultraviolet radiation on the surface that tends to break down organic molecules. And so, as John was saying earlier, there might not be any traces left. But we're going to look for those organics, and in particular, look for conditions early in Martian history that would have been suitable for life. And we were talking early about what have the accomplishments been. One early drilling and soil sampling by Curiosity showed that early Mars on the floor of Gale Crater had conditions that were very comfortable for life. It was neither too acidic nor too alkaline. There was water there. It was probably a very pleasant place to be. And what we're missing is the evidence of whether that spark of life was there.
Let's take another call. We've got Andrew on the line from Hampton Roads, Virginia. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
I was just wondering, since we knew that Mars once had a suitable habitat for life, how close are we technologically, if at all, to maybe changing or providing a new habitat or something where we could actually visit or inhabit Mars?
Jennifer, what about Andrew's question? And I'm going to add another one. First, when ballpark, do we think it is possible that we could land a human being on Mars? And then secondarily, is it even foreseeable that we could have people living there?
Yeah, I think it's something that we all look forward to in terms of landing a human on Mars. And there, as you know, there are lots of factors. There are political, financial, technological. So I think, you know, we're certainly decades away from landing a person on Mars just from a technology point of view.
The resources that you could usefully put to work, could it happen within 20 years?
Yeah, I think if we had all the resources, it could probably happen even a little faster than that. But we are currently constrained and we will be constrained. But yeah, I think, you know, similar to Apollo, if you apply a lot of resources and a lot of kind of innovation and engineering skills, we're going to be able to do that definitely within 20 years, I would say.
Let's take another call. We've got John on the line from Northampton, Massachusetts. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks. Yeah, I'm just calling in response to the gentleman who was expressing concern about the cost of this kind of research and the relative priorities that the other priorities that we might have. And it's really a comment to say that I don't think anybody really would question that a Beethoven symphony has a lot of value. I don't think that anybody would argue that a painting by Van Gogh has a lot of value. What is that value? You know, probably at the time it was created, people didn't understand it. And we may not understand the value of what you all are doing there. I find it really interesting, and I'm not a scientist. I think it's what makes us human, is the curiosity. It's an essential part of we are, and I'm glad you're doing it, and I hope it works out well, and I hope you get more funding to do more of what you want to do.
John, thanks so much for your call. John Grotzinger, are you going to be to accept being likened to Beethoven and Van Gogh?
Well, you know, there are parts of curiosity that do remind you of a work of art. When you see something that is so complicated working as a system, it is like watching a symphony. And I actually think it's an appropriate metaphor.
Yeah, and I'll add.
Go
I'll
ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, just from the inspiration point of view, I was a farm girl from Ohio who grew up raising animals and working in the fields. And there was one picture on the wall in our den. My dad had worked in the 50s in the kind of at White Sands and kind of the early rocket industry. And there was this picture and he had these stories, these amazing stories of these rockets going off. And just that single picture inspired me to think that, yeah, a farm girl from Ohio could go off and maybe drive rovers on Mars. And so my hope and the inspiration of the images that we have coming down from Curiosity is that the same kids, you know, the kids who are in elementary school and junior high will go, you know what, there's nothing that limits me. If I want to do this, I can do this, and I can do whatever I want. It doesn't have to be drive a rover on Mars. It can be anything. You know, it sort of allows people to think beyond the possibility of what they might have constrained themselves to.
Jennifer, could you talk a little bit? My understanding is that the next year for Curiosity is going to be largely involved in the trek, which isn't all that long, but is surely difficult, to a mountain near the crater that the vehicle is in now. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're pretty much every day we're driving towards Mount Sharp. And Mount Sharp is this history book that we want to get to understand Mars better. The driving that we get the data, we look at the images. We've actually got something called a rapid route that we've already looked at orbital images to try to figure out where the main obstacles are, and we've mapped around those main obstacles. So we kind of have a road defined, but every day we look at what we see in front of us, and that road can change. We've been averaging about 50 meters per day of driving. We have about 7.7 kilometers to go to Mount Sharp, but once we get our auto navigation working, we'll actually hopefully get to about 100 meters a day and hope to get to Mount Sharp in the spring, summer of next year.
Kelly, how optimistic are you about this mission specifically and about where this enterprise is headed given the budgetary and political pressures it faces.
Yeah, let's talk about technically and scientifically. We're a year into this mission. It's got a nominal two-year mission, which is basically one Martian year because that's how long it takes Mars to go around the sun.
Two-year expiration date?
That's right. And we've taken a year and basically spent all of that in an area about the size of a football field. But this is a complicated machine. It took a lot to learn how to drive it, how to use it, make sure all the instruments worked. They're booking it now toward Mount Sharp, Aeolus Mons is its formal name. And once it gets there, it's going to spend a lot of time deciphering the history. And the interesting thing is I mentioned at the top that this Opportunity rover that Jennifer worked on has almost spent 10 years on Mars. And a point I want, if they can address, is, there could be 10 years of operations for Curiosity on Mars easily because it has the means to last that long. And we're going to learn a lot about that planet over that period of time. It requires enough back here on Earth, the political will to keep it funded, but technically there's no impediment.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you as we go out because time is short, Kelly. How optimistic are you that enough budgetary space will be preserved that we can get something approximating the value that you think we should out of this?
I think Curiosity is going to be okay, but this could be the end of the road for Martian exploration for quite a while. The Obama administration, the Congress are not in a mood to give NASA a blank check.
Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine, thanks so much for coming into the studio. John Grotzinger, Chief Product Scientist for the NASA Mars Science Laboratory Project, thank you. And Jennifer Trosper, Deputy Project Manager for the Curiosity Project, so great to have you with us as well. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, The Mortal Sea. A ship's captain turned scholar tracks our impact on the oceans over time. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.